File 2084. Welcome, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2084 is the Department of Correction Policy Bill. This is a collection of four bills that was requested by the Department of Corrections. The first provision makes some changes to the Challenge Incarceration Program. That was a bill that I originally authored. Senator Harrington has element regarding the Fugitive Apprehension Unit. Senator Latz has a legislative reporting requirement. And the fourth section of the bill regards victim notification process. Section 1 is really the reason why the bill is in the Finance Committee, which is the legislative reporting requirements section of the bill. In a nutshell, the section gets rid of a Department of Corrections report. The report we're getting rid of is redundant because Department of Correction gives us the same exact information in another report they're required to give us just a few months later in the year. Here's kind of the background. A few years ago, Department of Corrections changed some of its performance measures, and in 2009, certain members of the legislature questioned the success of these performance targets. So the legislature mandated that the department give us a performance targets report due by August 31st of every other year. The problem is that all of the performance measures required in the August 34th report are also included in the Department of Corrections' biannual January performance report, which comes out a few months later in the even number years. The original idea was to keep the department accountable for this new performance measure. However, the performance measures have remained constant since 2009. So it's become very apparent to all of us that it's really not necessary. As you'll see by the fiscal note, the report costs the Department of Corrections approximately $8,000 to produce. However, in 2009, we did not appropriate any money for them to do the report. It ended up being absorbed at that time. Therefore, there's no true expected savings this year. Instead, staff time will simply be devoted to other reports critical to the agency's mission. I will stand for any questions, and I have other people here from the Department of Corrections if you have questions about that.
Are there any questions from the members? Senator Limmer, and maybe someone could answer this. Somebody just have a quick answer to that? What are some of those? Like, what is our daily per diem right now? And how does this report look?
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Ogroski. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Operations Support in the Department of Corrections. In this report, it's a target report that does report on our per diem, but again, like of that is health care, dental care, treatment, and just the daily cost for our offenders.
And has that stayed fairly constant over the last few years?
It does fluctuate some. It depends on how many offenders we have in our system. And we are a very staff-intensive organization, and so it also depends on what labor agreements have negotiated, because the staff costs actually have an impact on our per diem also.
Okay, and is your prison population up or down right now?
Actually, it has decreased about 200 offenders over the last 2 years.
Okay. Do any other members have questions? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I have a question that is in Section 4, which isn't a section that Senator Limmer talked about, but as I'm going on, I see it. And this is about the Challenge Incarceration Program up at Willow River. And a couple of years ago, because the program was not full, we expanded it to more people who would be eligible for the program. And I see now here we're going back and limiting it back again and paring down the number of people that are eligible. And I'm wondering what the background of this is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
If you look at Section 3, Senator Higgins, it's a little bit more specific to the in order to keep, we're directing the Department of Corrections to have a sufficient number of inmates in that program. And we are trying to make sure that the capacity stays strong. It's a very useful program. It's been highly regarded. We want to keep it that way. There was a time when we put so many limitations on the Department of Corrections that we couldn't even fill the program.
Right.
And so in this particular section, what we're doing is we're tightening it down just a little, but not enough. Like some offenders, we simply aren't putting in. Offenders that are of a high personal crime against or a crime against a person in a violent manner would not be included in that program, but the other programs that were restricted were giving to the discretion of the Department of Corrections, but with a specific direction that they must keep the program full.
Madam Chair and Senator,
Senator Higgins,
was there a problem?
Well, the problem
Senator
was is that a few years ago, we were by law prescribing who could go into the program and who could not, that the Department of Corrections couldn't keep the program full and was in danger of collapsing because there was not enough people to put into it for the scale of cost for such a small population.
Yes, Madam Chair,
Higgins.
Senator Limmer, I did that. Yes, I'm the one who expanded it again. I'm wondering why now you're paring it back down.
Well, Senator Limmer?
I'm not sure if we really are, but do you want to answer that question?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, what we have
could
found...
Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, excuse me. My name is Terry Carlson, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, what we found over the last couple of years with the language as it is that... There are some offenders that have pretty violent crimes that aren't restricted from the program that we are concerned about. And so we've been looking towards changing the language somewhat so that we could have some further restrictions. And yet, at the same time, I just want to make sure that everyone knows that we're very, very confident that we will maintain the capacity of the program. We have no interest in changing our policies so that we limit the program so much so that we can't keep it full, because we agree it's a very good program.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Carlson, is the per diem rate for that one significantly different than the others, or is it only so if you don't have it running at capacity?
Madam Chair, the per diem for the Challenge Incarceration Program, I don't know it off the top of my head, but the overall cost for the Challenge Incarceration Program is lower than a general prison bed because of the early release component. And so the more we can keep that program at capacity, the better off we are.
Thank you. Are there any other questions about Senate File 2084? Otherwise... Senator Ingebertson moves that Senate 2084 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. If there's no other questions, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 2084 will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Limmer. Next up, we have Senate File 1960. Senator Gimsey here. Yes.
Too,
we
huh?
Can start talking.
Impressed.
This is the one.
You guys don't really get up
there. Yeah. We are having some computer problems, and there is a fiscal note coming in just a moment. But
very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We had some panicked staff come running before and say that it was not able to be pulled up just yet. But we'll let you start explaining the bill, Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'm not exactly sure what it is about fiscal notes and my bills, but I seem to run into difficulties with that. But I do appreciate you taking the time and giving me the opportunity to present Senate File 1960. Senate File 1960 is a freight rail study that is an extension of a recent rail study that was completed by MnDOT in 2009, which was a comprehensive statewide freight rail and passenger rail plan for the next 20 years. What we would like to do with this study is to expand on that and show the economic benefits of freight rail in the state of Minnesota. And a part of that is the short rail lines that run around our state. There are 20 of them across the state that don't travel a long distance but play a huge part in the communities and the economic impacts within those communities. About 35% of the total freight in the state of Minnesota is moved by rail, and that's freight that comes in and goes out of Minnesota, and that equates to 235 million tons of freight each year. Our railroads employ over 4,000 Minnesota workers, and what we hope to do with this study is, again, show the economic impact of not just the larger freight rails, enterprises, but also these short, smaller regional railroads. And with me is John Appitz to explain a little further about that economic impact and the goals of this study.
Welcome, Mr. Appitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Appitz with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association here in Minnesota, which is an association of the short lines and regionals, and the short lines are the short-distance railroads, if you will, that operate here in the state. And I think you're actually going to get some material that talks about railroads. Patrick's handing out some material that we distribute. Talks about the impact that railroads have and the amount of freight that railroads move here in the state of Minnesota. Chairman Gimsey has been very eloquent and precise in describing what this bill does. Let me simply add that railroads have been an economic engine in Minnesota and across this nation for 150 years. This is the 150th anniversary, as a matter of fact, of the movement of the first train in Minnesota, the W.R. Crooks, which was the locomotive that J.J. Hill used to begin moving freight in Minnesota, is celebrating its 150th birthday. And you want to see that old engine, you can go up to Duluth and take a look at it in the Freight Museum up there. Railroads have been an essential element of developing business, jobs, industry across the state, and today in Minnesota they move about 35 to 40% of the freight that's here. Chairman Gimsey noted the comprehensive statewide freight and passenger rail study that was completed in December 2010. It was directed by the legislature to be completed in 2008 and was done in 2008 and was completed in 2010. It is a very good indexing of the railroad operations in Minnesota, and it provides a very good vision for passenger rail operations in Minnesota, laying out a number of different routes. One of the things it doesn't do, however, is really emphasize a vision for freight rail in Minnesota, in part because most of the freight railroads are privately owned, but they are part of the commerce here. And what this study would do, hopefully, is complete that vision for the freight side of the industry. The funding for this comes, I think, now that you have the fiscal note in front of you, comes from a program called the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, the MRSI program. I come in and beg for mercy every now and again, and that's not a bad thing to have to do, especially with legislators. And that fund is a revolving loan fund which has received money from the legislature over about the last 30 years that it has been in operation. In 2008, to complete the comprehensive freight and passenger rail study, that legislation was amended to allow for studies to be completed using funds in that particular fund. So that's the funding source. The money's there. It is in general fund appropriations that are being requested. The money is there and has been used for studies previously. I can just add, I believe that Mark Loftus, the Deputy Director of the Department of Deed, and Bill Gardner, who is the Director of the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicles at MnDOT, are here and can answer questions for you if you'd like. I just want to emphasize one last thing. When we were in committee in Chairman Gimsey's Transportation Committee, there was quite an eloquent plea, or if you will, endorsement of this bill from Senator Sharon, who has actually seen the impact of a railroad on a community in her district. Winthrop, Minnesota, a little town down in southwest, I think some of you have been there and gone through there, has a railroad that runs through it, if you will. And that particular railroad is the reason that they had expanded their ethanol production from about 33 million gallons to about 100 million gallons. They've added a fertilizer plant. They've added a warehouse facility for a number of other agricultural products. And it's because they've got a railroad that they can move to national markets and international markets that they've been able to do this. Little short line railroad that connects them to the world. And hopefully that will become a model that will come out of this study that Chairman Gimsey is bringing forward to be used in other instances across the state.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Mr. Apitz, I was on the Transportation Committee when we commissioned that particular study in the first place. The study that you referred to, originally it was supposed to also encompass freight. So did the study fall short? Did you feel like ultimately it didn't fulfill what it was set out to do? Because we didn't expect to come back 2 years later and have to be doing a separate comprehensive study of one piece of it.
Mr. Abbotts.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Bonoff, and you might ask the department, too, to speak to that. It was, as I said, a very visionary piece for passenger rail here in Minnesota, an industry that's fallen away, that hasn't really, you know, we haven't had passenger rail in Minnesota, I think, since about 68 or 69, and it took a look at how to recreate that. What it also did on the freight side is really just index, I think, the freight railroads and the challenges the freight railroads face in terms of maintaining their infrastructure, in terms of addressing future freight demand that was articulated, if you will. But in terms of being an economic development engine, it did not do that. In terms of looking at what railroads could be as a model for development in small communities across the state, it didn't do that. It wasn't directed to do that, by any stretch of the imagination.
Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair and Mr. Apitz, one of the things that bothered me about that particular report is I've been a strong advocate of looking at some of the shorter segments of the rail. So, for example, the segment that goes from the Twin Stadium to the Wayzata Depot. Okay, that is a very dense area. I think it would be a natural for passenger rail, but yet that report only studied it as though it was a rail line from the Twin Stadium all the way out to Wilmer, which, of course, is a very different situation because of the lack of density all the way out there. So I guess one of the things I'm wondering as if we're really going to go forward with a different study is the potential congruence between rail and passenger. And, you know, in the past when we've had to negotiate with some of the freight companies, they, you know, have been pretty tough negotiators when it comes to being willing to share the rail with the passenger. And, it, you know, this is a particularly economic way to go in terms of cost benefit to do commuter rail on some of these very strong lines. So is there any interest as you look at the economic engine of freight rail to include the potential of the partnership between them? And perhaps Senator Gimsey, you might have a comment to that.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Bonhoff, the goal of this study really is to show the economic impact of freight rail. And the comprehensive plan that was completed in 2010 did focus considerably on passenger rail. And what we want to do through this study is to show, use it as a tool to show businesses what opportunities are available as far as freight rail in Minnesota and the existing lines that are there. I think in addition of taking a look at the line that you're talking about would reduce the focus of what we're trying to accomplish here. But I appreciate your comments, and maybe there's a different way or another opportunity in which we can study that facet, if you will, of rail transportation.
Well, Madam Chair, just follow up. So how much money is in that fund, and is there still money left over?
Mr. Abbott?
Madam Chair, actually you should probably ask the department for a very specific analysis of that, but there's about $1 million that's in the account now, which is money that's returned on the loans that are distributed. Annually, they recover about $1 million in monies, and those then are relent. So this would be money that wouldn't be back, come back to the account, but we think it'd be well spent because there'll be more demand in the future. Could I just add one other thing, Madam Chair, to Senator Bonoff's question?
Certainly.
The assumption of the freight rail plan or the comprehensive rail plan was that any new passenger rail would be run on freight railroads, that we're not going to be laying down a lot of new railroads in the state of Minnesota. It's just not economically feasible anymore, nor is it almost logistically feasible. So you have to look at heavily traveled corridors versus not so heavily traveled corridors. The corridor out to Willmar is a BNSF corridor that is heavily traveled. It's a main line that runs east and west, and there's a lot of traffic on there. And one of the issues in play is, can you add, you know, can you put people on the same line that you're running freight on? That always is an equation that's difficult to work with. As Senator Gimsey mentioned, one of the things we hope to do with this is take a look at the short lines, which are underutilized by just about any measure, and figure out if there's ways to take more advantage of that capacity in terms of building jobs and industry.
Thank you.
Senator Gimsey?
And Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, the goal really is to reduce the truck traffic to some degree on our rural roads, which is an added benefit of increasing the use of the short rail lines. So.
I drove by the gas station this morning. Gas was $3.75 a gallon. I think that might be a driver to get more freight on rail. I mean, as the economics play out, I really think that'll push more people who want to transport into the rail, you know, lines, because it's probably going to prove more economical. Senator Newman, did you have a question?
I just had a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of Senator Gimsey's bill, I just wanted to tell you that, you know, out in my district, Mr. Abbott had mentioned Winthrop. We also have a regional rail just north of there in the Glencoe area. And those regional rail lines are trying desperately to get up and get running and to move freight. And to Senator Gimsey's point, it will help our infrastructure in terms of roads, because, you know, truck traffic really is pretty hard on our roads. Minnesota is a heavily agricultural area. So in addition to, say, moving corn for purposes of ethanol, it also opens up the world for all kinds of agricultural products. There is, in addition, just to the northwest of Winthrop, a new coal storage facility that is being built, and it's really a pretty big deal out in my area, and that has directly to do with coal being shipped in from out west and then stored and moved into my area. So, in terms of rural Minnesota, this idea of in effect reclaiming our railroads. And we really have allowed them to fall into just horrible disrepair. But it really is a good way to move freight from the rural areas other than on our highways. So I really do support this bill, Mr. Senator Gimsey.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I've been looking at the fiscal note, and I have a couple questions on page 3. The bill said that that the commissioner will conduct a study and then report. But I see on the fiscal note that it includes putting together an entire program called the FRED program, which I think is kind of cute, the Freight Rail Economic Development Program, and further guidance to prospective shippers, and then $60,000 for public outreach and preparing the report. So between the two, it's $100,000. And I'm wondering if the study, which is what the bill calls for, either we study it or we put together a program, but the bill doesn't say to do both. And so I'm wondering if part of the cost of this is really necessary. I mean, I kind of like public outreach, but gosh, that's twice my salary, you know? And so I'm wondering about the cost of that, but then the structure of the program, which seems to be outside the bounds of the bill. So a question about that.
Did someone want to
respond? There's a question in there somewhere.
Right. I'm suspecting that if we do the study, we want people to get the information. Does somebody want to address that issue?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator, as I understand the...
Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry. I'm Bill Gardner. I'm Director of the Freight Office at MnDOT. And as I understand the legislation, the bill would have several aspects to this study effort, including looking at the economic value of rail activity in the state and what initiatives could be undertaken to increase rail shipping and specifically to increase job creation associated with rail shipping. I believe that the word program really is more of a strategy at this point, certainly. It could include changes to our existing program, the Rail Service Improvement Program. It could include marketing. It could include various types of incentives and partnerships between public agencies and private industry. So I think an important part of this effort, if we were directed to do this, would be some significant outreach with the shipping community in particular. We need to better understand the railroads and their business strategy and how they market their services, but we need to understand how shippers make their transportation choices and decisions. So we would want to talk to existing rail shippers and potential rail shippers and look at those factors and focus on what are the best opportunities for increasing rail shipping and creating jobs. So I think these are different elements of an overall package, which are in part study, looking at what other states have done, looking at some assessment of business opportunities, but also a significant amount of outreach with economic development planners, with the freight railroads, and with the shippers themselves around the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry was next, but is it to that point?
Yeah.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps it's just misstated by saying public outreach. I think you've talked about more of a targeted outreach to the ones that would, in fact, use it. And I don't know who was responsible for that wording, if that's within the department when they make out the fiscal note. But, what you're saying makes a lot of sense, because that's where the market truly is, and you need to find out the information as well as let them know what might be the potential and get them thinking about it. It isn't the broader public, per se, that is the ones that need to be accommodated at this point.
I am simply assuming.
Senator Perry.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get a – I listened to Senator Bonoff, and, of course, I've been this whole session railing on the fact that we have the core reports that sat on a shelf for how long that we haven't really done much for. I'm still trying to get a handle on why we're doing for the rail companies what it appears they should be doing for themselves. Why is it we don't know what the economic impact is? Why is it we don't know what touches all the communities? Why is it the railroad has been here and built America, and we have to do a study to figure out what to do with them? I'm really having a problem here trying to figure out, and, don't get me wrong, but we should be, I guess maybe part of my fear is the study's going to get done, it's going to sit on the shelf again, because I don't hear any real action plan. Here's the intent after the fact, but Mr. Appitz, I don't know if this is directed towards you, but I'm having a hard time grasping this whole thing. Because to me, it just doesn't make sense that we don't already know this information, and that if you're coming to look for help from the legislature, it would be you're coming because you have a plan, and this is what you need to bring all these businesses and people, cities, counties together, but that's not what I'm hearing.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gimsey.
And then Senator Perry, you know, you touch on some very important points, but the purpose of the Mercy Fund is to promote and to develop and to assist in these freight rail initiatives. And a key part of that is certainly understanding the economic impacts, and I think that this study and this effort fit very well. You know, we look at a lot of different aspects of our economy, and the study that was completed in 2010, the comprehensive statewide study, was an important tool that we're using looking forward 20 years. We need this type of effort. We need to have this type of understanding as we move forward. If we don't gather the information, we will never be able to make good and sound decisions concerning the future of rail and these short lines in the state of Minnesota. So what we're hoping to accomplish here, I think, uses wisely the purposes of the Mercy Fund, and the goals are legitimate in that pursuit. So I don't know if you have something.
Mr. Abbott, did you want to comment further?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Senator Perry, you're absolutely right. If you are a Class 1 railroad, a major carrier, international carrier, the BNSF, the UP, the Canadian Pacific, Canadian National, you know what your economic plan is. You have a business plan laid out, and that business plan is going to go forward regardless of any of these studies. In many ways, that plan is going to happen. Mr. Gardner and I were at a seminar this fall where the BN laid out its plans for development of the grain, the the taconite, and the commercial products industry in Minnesota. This hopefully will look at two things. Number one, the short line industry. And I got to tell you, that's your retail industry. That's your mom-and-pop drugstore on the corner that doesn't have a lot of time to sit and think about what economic development it can do along its line. Because it was in Winthrop, and because some people looked at what could be done with a rail line running through Winthrop, the folks in Senator Newman's area who have an ethanol plant, who have a fertilizer plant, who have other sorts of plants, looked at that rail line, looked at what they needed to do, and put those pieces together, and they got some help from Deed in doing that as well. This really focuses on, if you will, the capillaries, not the arteries, and how we can stimulate those capillaries to generate jobs and business in greater Minnesota area, along those 19 lines that then tie into those, 17 lines that tie into the Class 1 lines, the larger ones.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gimsey, is this FRED program a relative of the TED program?
Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair and Senator Magnus, we like to think so.
Okay, well, I thought so. And Madam Chair, I've heard from the national transportation folks that our freight nationwide, our freight tonnage is going to go up nearly 40% over the next 10 years. So we've got a huge obstacle to, or the next 20 years, excuse me, we've got a huge obstacle to overcome. And I was jokingly talking about the FRED and the TED program, but the TED program, Transportation for Economic Development, is a program, as I understand it, and I'm trying to find more money to put into that program. Is a program that's a partnership between the local entities and the Department of Transportation, and indeed, to try to target some of our transportation monies and economic development monies to areas that are really needed and would trigger jobs and economic development. And as I understand this would do the same thing. Is that correct, Senator Gimsey and Mr. Gardner?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gimsey.
And Senator Magnus, you've hit it, I believe, spot on. And it's just another effort and another aspect of economic development and how we better use transportation, whether it be roads and bridges or rail, in the state of Minnesota, and really getting a better understanding of it.
Madam Chair, I had a meeting with Deed and Department and MnDOT, and we talked a lot about the TED program and how we could target transportation funds and tie it towards economic development. And I think that's I really think that's a great thing to do. And we just frankly don't have the money that we have had in the past. We don't know what the federal transportation funds are going to be, number one. We expect they'll be less. Number two, we don't know when they're going to come to us. And so we've got a lot of uncertainty on the national level. It's important that we do target these things. I think this is a good plan to study, to look at how we can target more of these funds, especially in light of the huge increase we're going to be seeing in freight movement. And we talked about this. Senator Newman talked about getting trucks off the road and getting them into a cheaper mode of transportation, hold the cost down to help our competitiveness around the world, and help us in the long term keeping our road system in good shape. So, Madam Chair, I would move Senate File 1960 to go to the General Register on the floor.
Thank you, Senator Magnus. I do have a couple of questions on the fiscal impact yet. On lines 1.21 and 1.22, it gives a Commissioner of Transportation the authority to expend money, but it doesn't say how much money. Could we go off of the fiscal note and actually put in a dollar amount? Because otherwise it's very open-ended. I say, suppose we could amend it to say expend up to $216,000 in fiscal year 2013. Would be appropriate?
Madam Chair, I think that would be appropriate.
Members, do you feel more comfortable putting a cap on that? Mm-hmm. Okay, then the amendment would say, the line would say, the Commissioner of Transportation may expend up to $216,000 in fiscal year 2013 under section 222.50, and then on to line 1.22. Any questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And then I just wanted to have Deed come up quickly because there's a little fiscal note for them. I understand that they're willing to absorb this for some services that they'll be providing for this study and the collaboration that you're doing.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm a Director of Business and Community Development at Deed. The bill does, Senator Magda said, reflect off of the TED program in the sense of collaboration between our departments. And there is a relatively small portion of time that Deed would put into this from our research and analysis staff, but it appears, as the fiscal note says, that we would be able to absorb that at a relatively small cost, but to continue our partnership on the research and evaluation of economic development.
Any questions on that? Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify for or against? If not, Senator Magnus renews his motion that Senate File 1060 or 1960.
Pardon? Madam Chair,
Senator,
I just wanted to make a kind of a general statement about the importance of railroads in rural Minnesota. I got a small town in my district, northeast of Moorhead, 500 and some people. They shipped out 68 unit trains of grain this last year. A unit train is 100 cars or better. A lot of the tax base that goes to the school district there comes from that elevator, and a lot of the employment in that town comes from the elevator. And I've really seen this evolve over a period of years. Years back, these elevators had a hard time getting cars. They'd get 3-4 cars, and then the elevator would fill up and everything. Now they got this whole system where the smaller elevators ship the grain into the unit train elevator, and these 100 cars go zipping out of there every few days. So it's really evolved, and it's they don't happen to be on a short line, but it just shows just how important the rail is to the whole economy of rural Minnesota. And the farmers get a higher price at that elevator because the freight is so much cheaper and so on. So I just kind of wanted to make that as a general statement as to what the railroads really do to rural Minnesota when they're adequate.
Senator Ingerbertson, comment?
Senator Gimsey, I apologize. I stepped out of the when Mr. Appitz was talking, but the study is funded by the Rail Service Improvement Program. That's a special revenue fund. How does that money come in?
Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that is a revolving loan account where we give money to these regional rail authorities, and they make their improvements and then pay that money back into the fund. And then, and also on occasion, we ask for more money to go in there so that we can broaden the scope of that fund and broaden the availability of those dollars to improve these short line, more localized rail systems.
Okay. Thanks.
It's a relatively small fund. It doesn't carry, like Mr. Appet said, it carries a balance of about $1 million, but there are significant dollars out there that are working, and as those loan proceeds come back into the fund, they're sent out, if you will, again.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Otherwise, Senator Magnus renews his motion that Senate File 1960 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
Yeah. And placed on general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next, we have Senator Hall. I think he's here. He was before. Welcome, Senator Hall. Senate File 1678.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1678 is a bill clarifying representation of those who cannot afford an attorney in the criminal or child protection matters. This bill is brought to me by Kevin Kyer, the Executive Director of the State Public Defender's Office, and John Tuma from the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and they are here to answer questions that you may have in regard to the provisions. Our goal was to create a zero-cost solution that creates greater certainty around the question of who represents those who cannot afford an attorney in criminal and child protection matters. Unfortunately, due to the clarity of our statutes, counties and public defenders have been expending significant amounts of resources on the appeals around the question of who provides this representation. Therefore, when Mr. Kyer and Mr. Tuma came to me before session, they were working on framework to settle some of these disputes. I decided to author this bill. Since the bill's introduction, we have been willing to listen to many concerns, and we have worked with the varying parties to try to come with workable solutions. This is a compromise piece of legislation, and as a result, is not perfect for any one party, but I believe it's a good step forward in our goal to creating a greater certainty and reducing needless litigation. As you can see from the fiscal note, the impact on the Public Defense Board, the courts, and the counties are very reasonable. Our goal is to come up with essentially a no-cost solution, and I think we've accomplished that task. I believe that all entities will be able to absorb these costs without appropriations. With that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Kyer and Mr. Tuma to answer any questions regarding the details of this legislation.
Thank you, Senator Hall. And we do want a little bit more of an overview, perhaps, but we are looking at the fiscal notes in particular, and I see that there are some savings in some areas and zero cost in others. So it's not a bill that we're going to have a lot of financial concerns about. Because it looks like it's not going to costing the general fund any money. In fact, saving maybe a bit. But if we could just, because we have to pass the whole bill out, we'd just like to have a little better overview. So I don't know, Mr. Kyer, do you want to start?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. As Senator Hall indicated, the issues contained in this bill are some that we have been going back and forth with the counties basically since the state assumed the cost of public defense back in the late 80s and early 1990s. The real heart of the bill in terms of the financial impact are Sections 1 and Sections 9. In Section 1, the bill eliminates a statutory right to counsel for appeals of end-of-confinement review hearings for predatory offenders. This was passed back in the middle 1990s as part of the community notification statutes. When the offender comes out of incarceration, there is a review done. They are designated a 1, a 2, or a 3. If they're designated a 2 or 3, they have a right to an appeal of that and then also have a statutory right to counsel. There is no clear constitutional right to counsel. That's not to say in the future that there may not be some court somewhere that finds one, but right now it's only statutory. In exchange for, or if matched with that, if you will, this summer the Minnesota Supreme Court found that there is a constitutional right to an appeal of a misdemeanor case. Right now, the Office of Management and Budget is paying for those out of a general contingency fund. What Section 9 would do would add that to the responsibilities of the State Public Defender's Office. From a financial standpoint, eventually, not right away because it is just starting, we expect that that will be a wash in terms of workload. The folks that are right now doing those end of confinement review appeals would then start doing those misdemeanor appeals within that same office. The small piece that you do see in terms of a cost to us are the cost of trial transcripts. Every time there's an appeal, our folks have to order a trial transcript from the court reporter who was staffing that particular courtroom. We pay for not only our copy, but then pay for a copy for the prosecution and also for the court. We spend about $600,000 to $650,000 a year on trial transcripts. We budget about $300,000. Once the $300,000 is gone, we tap into an emergency fund that's in the statute. Once that's gone, we basically hold the bills until the new fiscal year comes, and then we start paying again. Those of you who have been around here a little bit, this is nothing new to you. We've been dealing with this issue for 20 years or more. So there is a slight fiscal impact, but as I said, the $13,000, potentially $18,000 in the out years, really isn't a lot when you consider we're spending about $650,000 a year. So that's really kind of, from our standpoint, the fiscal impacts. And I don't know if Mr. Toome has got any indication on the county side.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, from the county's perspective, we entered into this discussion developing a framework with the Public Defenders Board out of a case that arose out of my county that I pay property taxes in, Rice County, in a court decision by former Senator Tom Neville, actually. That was the one that actually went to the Supreme Court. It's called the Randolph decision. And in that decision, the court determined that Senator Neville's or Judge Neville's order to make Kevin's shop pay for misdemeanors appeals wasn't correct, but that the state still is obligated to provide this representation. And that's why MMB has been stuck with bills by the court. And when you do that, when you ask a judge someplace out in the hinterlands to send an order to MMB to fulfill the obligation providing representation, there's not the cost oversight that the State Board of Public Defenders can give them. So we really are losing money in this battle. We were also part of the folks that were potentially responsible to pay for that misdemeanor appeals. The court ruled the other way. But in the long run, if we cannot prosecute misdemeanors and that every misdemeanant knows that if he just says, I appeal, he gets a get-out-of-jail-free card, or it's going to cost the state a ton of money, the appeals get hindered, and our ability to enforce laws at the local level are impacted, and our ability to manage the costs of our trial appellate cases becomes a financial burden on counties. So resolving these questions between who is supposed to provide representation doesn't have a direct identifiable dollar figure that you can put to it, but it does have a real cost savings to counties because now we can manage our cost, we can identify who is going to provide that representation and work out some reasonable contracts with those individuals on a volume basis as opposed to one-on-one cases that are coming up here. I think the state going standard right now for these appeals is like $10,000 is what the attorneys who are taking on these appeals are doing. And what we do in this bill is actually provide some reasonable restrictions on those costs. And so for counties and property taxpayers, this is a benefit for Minnesotans. So you are saving some costs. You can't really identify it directly, but there really are good, some good cost savings for counties.
So, Mr. Tuma, how many indigent persons apply or appeal misdemeanors? And did you, you kind of indicated that they might do it not because they might win an appeal, but because it gets them out of jail for a time?
Well, actually, I'll cover just first, and I'll pass off to Kevin because he has better information. A lot of what's happened is they've already actually served their time. It's the collateral consequences a lot of them are worried about more so. So a lot of times when they get to the appeal point, they've already done their sentence. They're already done their – they're just going to be put on, you know, some sort of paper probation. There might be some collateral consequences. They have a nursing license. They have several things. And so they're going to push – they're going to push the appeal to try to get out of that responsibility. So there is a difficulty for prosecutors when they're faced with those situations. And so – even though it doesn't happen a lot, it's going to happen, and you're going to have more and more of it, particularly as you create more and more collateral consequences, like you can't have a license if you're convicted of this crime.
Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair and members, last year there were roughly 50 of these appeals at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Those aren't broken down by who had a private lawyer versus who had court-appointed counsel. What we do know from some past experiences, as the right is established and as people understand that they have a right to an attorney, those numbers generally go up. And so while we're not sure what that number is going to be, we have a pretty good guess, you know, at least as this case law starts to develop. The other question that you asked was about the dismissal, I think, is in that court decision in Randolph, the court mandated that the state start to pay for these misdemeanor appeals, and if in fact they weren't going to pay for those appeals for whatever reason, that the court would start to vacate those convictions. And I think that's what Mr. Tuma is talking about is as prosecutors, they don't want to go through this whole process, prosecute the cases, and then end up having that conviction dismissed. And so that was the concern from the prosecutors.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, let me ask a few questions. First of all, Senator Hall, we've got the counties, we've got the Board of Public Defense. What's the position of the Supreme Court Administrator relative to this bill? And is there anybody here from the court?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, we did meet with the court on this bill early on. They did raise a few concerns about the original draft, and I think we addressed those. I can't specifically state now if they have any additional concerns. I know that they didn't testify at the hearing in Senator Limmer's committee. But we did meet with them early on to address some of the concerns they had in the original draft.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't serve on Senator Limmer's committee anymore, or never served on the Senate Members Committee, but don't serve on the Judiciary Committee, so didn't hear the testimony there. But obviously, I've been involved with the court budget in the past pretty significantly, and actually have some experience with parts of this bill. I was the author of the original CHIPS bill, the chief author of that bill, and for a period of time had a contract of some sort with Hennepin County Public Defender to do conflicts work that involved juvenile matters, so involved a lot of CHIPS stuff. So let me ask some disparate questions about the bill. First of all, relative to the CHIPS issue, I mean, are there any – the language allows for appointment of a public defender if warranted, and I recognize what's happened with the budget and where we've gone in terms of representation. But does this allow for a court – and I don't know, maybe – Sarah Newman could speak to non-metro courts, but certainly in the metropolitan courts, obviously particularly Hennepin and Ramsey, where you have a significant number of matters on the calendar, where you just get a slew of cases. I mean, what kind of equal protection kinds of issues do you get into, where you haven't appropriated any new money for your office, you know, for the Board of Public Defense?
other than, as you suggest, transcript. I mean, what happens if we find we now get back to a system where county by county there are significant costs placed in the county for, say, juvenile representation? What happens if we have, hypothetically, a judge in Hennepin saying, you know, I'm not going to make a determination of one versus another, that they all get counsel?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll let Mr. Tuma address that piece. What the bill does here is to clarify what the past court decisions have done. So what in the bill, we are clarifying that the representation of parents, guardians, and custodians is a county responsibility, which was a court decision in the case of SLJ from 2 years ago. We represent children over 10 in those cases, and that's all. So all we're doing is clarifying, putting into statute basically what that SLJ case determined 2 years ago now.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Kyer, I understand that, but so maybe the question is directed toward Mr. Tuma. So what happens if now we have everybody entitled to representation based upon an order of one district bench or another?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, the answer to that question is we start by trying to create a presumption when you walk into the initial hearing that the family's interest will be represented by an attorney who is contracted through the county board. Now, the state of Hennepin is a little different. They've always controlled their public defense structures. They did not give it up. There was not the trade that occurred when the state takeover happened back in the 1990s. They wanted to manage their own costs, and so their system is a little different because they've chose to manage that, and that's perfectly fine. For the rest of the state, though, the question had arose is, do we provide that representation? Several counties did not believe that we were obligated to provide the representation for the parent, the custodian, or the guardian. We lost that case in SLJ, and they used what we felt was a very thin statute to make that happen. And so it was kind of made a little bit, in our minds, out of whole cloth, and we were left with not the same kind of controls and management structures that are needed to be able to ensure that we get good quality attorneys into those offices to provide that representation. And so what we do with this bill is to create basically the structure by which a county board would select the law firms out there to provide that representation and require the judges to appoint those individuals. In conflict situations, they would, again, work with the county board, not the county attorney, but the county board, as far as identifying individuals who provide that representation like a law firm like yourself has. And so that's really what we're putting in place here. The obligation exists under constitutional law, under the court decisions that have come forward. And so we're just putting in here the mechanisms by which we can manage those costs. So when you walk into the courtroom in the initial hearing, there will be at a minimum an attorney representing every child over age 10, and there will be an attorney representing the interest of the parent. At that stage, it is anticipated that one of the first questions the courts will ask, is there any differing interest amongst the children, and is there any differing interest amongst the adults in this situation? If there is, we provide that representation, and that's spelled out in the statute that we continue to provide it. So we have to provide multiple counsels. We can't just have one law firm to do that representation, and the judges make those determinations. These are constitutional rights, so we can't deny them getting that representation. So we know that when we start out the case, we may have to have multiple attorneys representing the interest of the adults in the room, and Kevin's shop may have to provide multiple attorneys to represent the interest of the children. But at least when we start out with the presumption of that we don't need multiple attorneys, and that's a decision the court will have to make as we go down that road.
Well, Madam Chair, a couple of other questions. My guess would be, and my experience suggests, that a judge is going to err on the side of representation. And I probably made a mistake in using Hennepin as the example, but it's the largest county. But go to any other county. Go to another sizable county, Anoka. And there'll be some, at some point, I would guess, some significant costs imposed on the county, and then the counties will come and suggest the Board of Public Defense ought to take over these costs. The Board of Public Defense will come to us and say they need more money, and the Supreme Court may or may not agree with that. That's why I wondered where the Supreme Court might be on this. So I, it seems to me that, and I'm not against this, I mean, my position has always been the position you articulate, that there are, that folks ought to have the ability to have counsel. I mean, obviously, CHIP's petitions to just use that particular area are not, it's not a they're not termination of parental rights, although it could be the prelude to that, depending on the nature of the case. But looking at the totality of the legislation, just that's wondering where some of the other parties are. Another question, for instance, is there's an attempt, to, Madam Chair, in this bill to strengthen the determination of public defender eligibility. Obviously, a concern for the Board of Public Defense with limited funds is everybody gets a public defender. But as I read this language, and I don't know what's intended, that's why I'm wondering where the Supreme Court or the district court judges might be, it suggests that it can't be an inquiry, it has to be a determination. So will each district court set up a more significant determination of public defender eligibility? And what does that mean? Does that mean there's a more careful analysis, as there might be with other kinds of public assistance, as opposed to you just fill out the form and the judge says, yeah, I guess you're eligible for public defender representation? And what does that mean in terms of court time, where you have a more significant determination? You know, the judge has got an arraignment calendar of 22 people that morning. And now will the judge spend the morning making a determination and the afternoon handling the calendar? I mean, that's – so, Mr. Kyer, what's
– Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, first to the issue of the CHIPs and the children over 10 at least is – typically how this works, and I checked with all of our chief public defenders prior to the last hearing, was typically how it works is the court will appoint a lawyer to represent the kids over 10. Generally, they do have the same interests. If, in fact, once we get that case, there's a determination either by the attorney or by our chief public defender or our managing attorney that there is a conflict between the interests of those children, then we will assign a separate lawyer for them as opposed to the court doing it. And that's worked pretty well around the state, and we have some good relationships with the judges on those issues. Our chiefs work very hard on that. So we don't have a lot of concern about that. On the eligibility, the eligibility criteria, or at least the strengthening of this, really came out of a legislative auditor's report from 2010. And it was, frankly, much more extensive when the original draft of this bill came out. We have not heard anything from the court regarding the difference between a review and a determination. I think what the Office of the Legislative Auditor was looking for was a more definitive role to say, once you review that application, we want you to make a determination, as opposed to just saying, yeah, I reviewed the application, but you know what? We're just going to appoint a public defender to everybody or to those who are borderline. And I think when they went out to do their field reviews, they did find some of that. Not everywhere. Obviously, it's different depending on, you know, what court administration or the judges in particular areas. So I think that was their concern, that we get to more of a statewide standard and a statewide determination of eligibility.
Madam Chair, let me...
Senator Cohen, we do have to keep moving. We have two more bills, but go ahead.
Let me ask one other question and a comment, but I think I caught some language in here that suggests that if a prosecutor is going to... Did I read that correctly? Yeah, the court shall inquire of a prosecutor whether the prosecutor intends to certify the case as a petty misdemeanor, so you don't need public defender representation. So what power or authority does that take away from a prosecutor to negotiate if you're doing it at the front end for the prosecutor? And that's why I'm wondering if the County Attorneys Association, I don't know if there's a City Attorneys Association, if prosecutors have been involved with this.
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, we did meet with had a phone conference with, I guess it's the Executive Committee of the County Attorneys Association. It is permissive language, so it really doesn't take that authority away. What we're suggesting is, in those places where this might work, what we'd like to see is having that determination made ahead of time so we don't have to assign a lawyer, we don't have to open a file. This particular provision was passed in an eligibility bill last year that ended up getting vetoed by the governor. So I don't know if this committee saw that last year, but it was passed last year. So it just gives the opportunity to, let's say, let's try to make this work in some places where we may have the opportunity to have it work.
I'm going to interrupt your line of questioning and go to Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question for Mr. Turner, if he could come to the table, and a follow-up for Mr. Tuma, if he could stay at the table. Mr. Turner, on the fiscal note, page 13, there is noted that there is a local fiscal impact, and then when I turn to page 15, it essentially says we don't know what that fiscal impact is going to be. Then if we go to page 16, it says there is a local fiscal impact, and on page 18, it says counties are going to bear the cost of council in many of the provisions in the bill, but again, there's no numbers. Could you just briefly explain to me a little bit how to help me understand the problem in coming up with any kind of numbers as far as the local fiscal impact is concerned? I hope I'm not asking an unfair question, but...
No, that's fair enough, Madam Turner. Chair, members. Actually, before I get to that, I would like to point out that this shows a savings to the court of $12,000 a year, and that's actually from a provision that was deleted from the original bill. It limited the rights to felony appeals to cases where there was an upward departure from the recommended sentence. That was deleted from the bill, so this Supreme Court savings is no longer relevant. As far as the rest of the fiscal note is concerned, I think Mr. Kier put it best in that we tried to do Section 1 and Section 9, we kind of figured was a wash in workload shift. I think it is very, I think it's difficult for the estimates for local units of government to figure out a note like this. I don't have a good answer for you, I guess.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that very candid and honest answer, Mr. Kerr, and I honestly wasn't trying to put you on the spot. And it seems to me that we are kind of struggling to come up with the impact on the local units of government. So my question to Mr. Tuma is, you have indicated that you feel that there is a savings in terms of the local impact. The fiscal note says there will be an impact, but we don't know what that number is. So my question is, are you representing to us that you believe that overall there will be a savings to the counties, and have they bought in on this settlement between the counties and the Public Defender Board?
Mr. Tuma.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, the answer to that is, on the buy-in, we have worked very carefully with AMC, with my association. I represent the Minnesota Intercounty Association, which is 13 of the mid-sized counties outside of Hennepin Ramsey, and working through this to figure out how we can manage these costs. We're not saying that we're losing any responsibilities, but we're really not gaining any responsibilities under these provisions. The courts already shifted the mandate to us a few years ago in the court case of SLJ. And your counties, even though they disagreed with that decision, immediately stepped forward and started putting together contracts of individuals to represent parents who are in child protection cases. So now every county in the state of Minnesota has put these contracts together. They're with local law firms to provide that representation. We're absorbing those costs. What we don't know is, because the statute that the court decided on was very thin on how that authority really comes to us, we needed to have clarity in the statute. There really is nothing that stops a future judge from ordering a decision that says, you know what, my law clerk just start open up a law practice, and in my court, all child protection cases must go to that law firm, and they must pay X. There's nothing in the statute that would stop a future judge from doing that. Now, our judges, and I will give bonus to our district court judges for this, they have been playing very fair to us, and they've been appointing only those attorneys that the county boards have contracted to do this service. Because, as you know, when you can contract for a bulk, you're going to get a lower rate than you are going to get from individual cases being thrown at the court. And the cost just goes up because the attorney has to recognize, I'm only going to have this one case. I'm going to have to use my full billable hour. But if I know I can do this case for a lot less, I'm going to do it for a set fee that's lower than. And we've been able to manage those costs. But there's nothing that stops a judge from sticking it to us somewhere down the road at some point in the future. This bill provides that protection, saying to the court, you must appoint those attorneys that the county board has put forward. If there's a conflict, the county board has to find somebody else to do that in consultation with the chief judge, and they must meet certain minimum training requirements. And so we're willing to do those things. That was that interchange that we've had with the courts on this issue. And so that's what gives us that certainty of management of those costs. Those costs already exist. But now we have some certainty to know when we put that budget in there for $200,000 for these attorneys, it's going to be $200,000 and not going to balloon into $400,000 or $500,000 because you got a few rogue judges in that particular jurisdiction. So I don't think you can point to it and say it manages it, but it allows or it saves us, but it gives us a chance to manage those costs.
Madam Chair, if I can.
Senator Cohen, to this issue.
Just a quick comment. Because I think Senator Newman's questions point out concerns that I would have, and not to suggest, Madam Chair, that the folks here have not attempted to work with the Supreme Court decisions, have attempted to present something reasonable to this committee and the legislature, but my concern would be unintended consequences. That I don't think this will be the last we'll hear of this. Where some of these issues will be presented to the trial court. The trial court will err on the side of representation. The trial court will err on the side of this determination of eligibility as to what's involved with that. So the issue might come back to us in a greater sense. Years ago, when I served on state departments in the House, and Mr. Ellingson in the back will remember this because he was on state departments in the House at the same time, there was a very conservative member of the committee from Montevideo, Representative Welker, who said as we were discussing the court budget in the committee that he always supported more money for the courts because justice delayed was justice denied, and kind of echoed in that committee that morning. And I've always supported erring on the side of money for the courts, but I do think that this, although well-meaning, and I think today would appear to be workable, I'd be concerned about what might happen on a county-by-county basis. One county might try to comply with the letter of what's here, and another county might go a different direction, and the trial court, the particular district bench, might go a different direction.
And I'm sure those are things we can't control right now, and if it becomes a big budget issue, I'm sure they'll be back next year when we do our biennial budget. Does anyone else want to testify for or against the bill? If not, do I have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry. Senator Perry moves that Senate File 1678 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Hall, and your testifiers. Thank you for working on a compromise that you could come to us with. Next on our agenda is Senator DeCryth. He has Senate File 1843. It was on the agenda last week. We didn't have time for it, so he's back with us today. Welcome, Senator DeCryth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Senate File 1843 would keep the state parks open in event of another state shutdown. This bill simply allocates funds from the state parks account so the state park can remain open during any future state shutdowns. The fees that the state park receive for camping and other recreation is deposited into this account And I don't see a reason why these funds shouldn't be allocated. The net income to the state that was lost during the shutdown last summer was nearly $350,000. It only makes good common sense that when we're arguing about money, that we keep the money supply coming into the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. I think we all understand this. They could eventually run out of money, correct, Senator Kreif? Obviously, the summertime is their busiest time, and they collect fees from campers. And it would be going into their fund if that was depleted and new general fund dollars were not appropriated. I imagine that it would affect them. But in the early stages when they have reserve funds and fees coming in, you intend to keep those to keep the parks open during that time, correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. We also lost the you know, the big weekend, the 4th of July weekend, and it seems to me that that punishing the people of Minnesota just doesn't make any sense when we're having to do our work up here. But I don't think inflicting the pain upon Minnesotans is the right way to go. And what I'm hoping that we can do is get together with the governor now over this bill and agree, when we don't have a lot of pressure on us, that there's some things that we just shouldn't shut down and hurt the people of Minnesota.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, I've seen these bills come through here, several of them. I haven't seen anything come through here that would protect people in nursing homes or other facilities. That I've got some small businesses in my district that were not paid. They deliver medical supplies, and they were not paid when the shutdown happened. I think if we piecemeal this thing, we're going to just end up promoting shutdowns, because we'll have excluded those things that perhaps people worry about the most or are concerned about the most but aren't necessarily life-saving. Mm-hmm. Life-saving events. So, you know, I really, really am surprised by the kinds of bills that have been brought forth on this issue. State parks, the zoo, you know, electricians, a little bit here and there, but really nothing about the life-saving services that we have in this state. Not a single one of those kind of bills have come through here yet, and that just amazes me. And if that's not our first concern in the state, then we're barking up the wrong tree, and this bill is very unnecessary.
Senator Goodwin, the key word was yet. There's more bills coming. Senator Boniff, did you want to comment?
Well, Madam Chair, that was my question. I actually wondered if you could share with the committee, what are the other bills coming that relate to shutdown, so that we have a broader perspective as we evaluate them?
I'm not sure. Senator Boniff, I believe there must be about 15 bills. We're not going to hear them all. A number of them after this, there's a lot of cumulative ones that are looking at a bigger picture, funding at 70%, 80%, 90%, 100%. There's one that we just received that looks at funding all of them that have their own special revenue funds, for example, fees. We would just approve them all at once. And, you know, certainly now that we've been hearing these, that one wouldn't be too hard to take up and say, okay, should we just do everything in case we've missed some? And so we're going to do a couple more of those bigger ones, and that would be something that Senator Goodwin is talking about, a bill that would address all of the different funding areas. You know, we did have, during the shutdown, the special master ordered immediately. There was no impact on a number of are called critical services. And so I think when members started putting these together, they weren't thinking that those were things we had to address, because they had automatically been addressed by the court saying these are critical services. And yet we are going to take a look at that and say, should we let the special master decide that, or should we just do that ahead of time? So that's what's happening.
Okay.
Senator Kreif.
Madam Chair, and Senator Goodwin, a number of the bills that I've brought forward are bills that constituents of mine have called me about. and we're anxious about. So these are some of the things that are with my constituents that were important. Now, I would encourage you, if you have some of your constituents that you feel have issues, to bring one forward, because I do believe that there's areas of government that shouldn't be held hostage to a state shutdown. There will be times again when we have split government, and there should be some areas that are just off base that it doesn't make any sense to not have open. Also, the court did rule on a number of areas, so those areas aren't areas that I keyed on. I keyed on the areas that were shut down that I believe should not have been.
Madam Chair, can I respond?
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, you know, that's well and good, but I just want to remind you that this is only the second time in decades that state government has been shut down. Once was under Governor Pawlenty, now this time under the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate. So my suggestion is let's just do our work and start it earlier than we did last year.
Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, who was in charge of the legislature under Governor Pawlenty?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it was Republicans in the House when I was there, and it was Democrats in the Senate by a couple of votes.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson. Goodwin, we've had split government ever since Governor Perpich. We've always had split government that whole time. So it depends on just what, you know, what side you're, I don't know, for the slice that your bread is buttered on, but as to who you're going to point the finger at and blame. But I think we just ought to get off that track.
Well,
our people sometimes like to elect a split government. They want to keep those tensions and have some checks and balances, and they have a perfect right to do that.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson.
Senator Goodwin.
The fact of the matter is that it was only twice, and they're both in this decade, and they were both unnecessary. And no matter how you look at it, and it's unnecessary to ever do it again, we need to get our work done.
No argument.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Goodwin or Senator Kreif, you know, state parks were probably one of the biggest issues under any shutdown, if you remember. I mean, this was just before the 4th of July, and people had planned on coming from all over the country to enjoy our beautiful parks, and all of a sudden they're shut down. So there became a discussion that before the shutdown, actually, and I've said this before, that I didn't contact the governor's office. We actually had in our bill $1 million more than what he wanted for state parks that particular year, which was last year, and there was really no need for a shutdown, but he chose to do that, and that's fine. That is his decision. I don't, you know, we all have to live with that. But the bottom line is, we lost a lot of money, a lot of opportunities, and I hope this doesn't affect our state park opportunities this year. When you're talking about fiscal responsibility, we lost an awful lot of potential good customers because of shutting the state park, and that state park is owned by everybody. That's public ground that we all own. Nursing homes, as Senator DeKreif is saying, if you've got a bill that wants to keep nursing homes on, keep the lights on in nursing homes during a shutdown, I think there's quite a few around this table that would join with you. I really do. But state parks is a little bit different in that everybody owns this property, and we lost a lot of money by shutting that down for the 2 weeks.
Senator Perry?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate File 1843 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
On that motion, Senator Stumpf?
I just have a question on a fiscal note. And I don't know, maybe this would be for whoever put the fiscal note together. The assumption is that under the assumptions, there's no new revenues would be generated and no new expenditures would result. So there is no fiscal impact. Who actually put that together?
Did someone from the DNR do it? Would you like to come up and address that?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The assumptions in the fiscal note assume that parks would operate the same way, that new revenue would be above and beyond what we would normally generate. So you can see below We can talk about the money that was lost during the shutdown, about $1.8 million. We would assume that $1.8 million would come in, so we would be funding our operations. What we're estimating is about a staff of 900 or so would be needed to be maintained to operate the parks, and that would be complemented by other people within other divisions to provide the services, management resources, for example, for buildings and grounds and trucks and things like that, along with our enforcement people as well. So,
Madam Chair, so the way the department looks at new revenues, like when the governor requests the department to put their budget together, it would be basically ongoing revenues, even though the legislature has to approve it, you don't really consider that new revenues?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, I believe this is the same assumption that was made on the zoo fiscal note as well. And it's we're working with MMB to come up with this direction here. You can see the next line under that sentence. The fiscal note assumes that state park account would be allowed to go negative to initially cover expenses normally incurred in all three accounts. So that would allow us to be – we would be operating the state park account as if it was a statutory account at that point in time. As you may recall, the zoo was saying because their account was – it was a statutory appropriation that they were able to spend those dollars. If the state park account were to be statutory, we would have access to those dollars without being appropriated them by the legislature.
Mr. Meyer, quick question. Why did the – special master say that the zoo could continue operation and not the state parks? Did anyone appeal that?
No need for the license.
Madam Chair, I was not working in the capacity to take on any of those opportunities, but it was something that I believe the zoo hired independent counsel to challenge. So obviously we would rather talk about not shutting down government than trying to keep parks open. I mean, it's as simple as that, but you need to realize we will need a substantial workforce. If this bill is to go forward and we face that again, it would be roughly a third to almost a half of the DNR employees would be needed to operate and support the park system in its current capacity.
So, but it wouldn't be any more or any less than there are right now.
Madam Chair, we're ramping up for our parks seasonal staff at this point in time, so depends on what's next. It wouldn't be any more than we would have any other summer.
Correct. Okay. Senator Perry.
I'd request a roll call, Madam Chair.
Okay, on that motion, the clerk will take the roll on Senate File 1843.
Senator Bonoff.
Pass.
Senator Cohen. Senator Fischbach.
Yes.
Senator Goodwin.
No.
Senator Hahn.
Yes.
Senator Higgins. Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Langseth.
No.
Senator Magnus. Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Nienau.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Yes.
Senator Perry.
Yes.
Senator Stumpf.
No.
Chair Roebling.
Yes.
Senator Bonoff.
Yes.
On a vote of 8-3, the motion does prevail, and Senate File 1843 will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator DeCripe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Olson has a Commerce Committee, which will be coming in here next, and he also has the next
Senator
bill.
I'm sorry.
Hear
me like that.
Senator Gerlach. And he said that he would like to get this bill done. And we'd like to get his committee in here around 10:30, so we'll try and do this as quickly as we can. We did indicate that we'd like just 5 minutes testimony from each side, and we'll give you a chance, Senator Gerlach, to explain the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This will be brief. This is Senate File 230, known as the Nurse Licensure Compact. And it's a bill that would put Minnesota into that compact where there are currently 24 other states participating. And this will allow our nurses additional mobility in being able to practice across state borders in what essentially is a new economy and provide a lot of opportunities. We had extensive testimony, and we heard this bill, the policy of this bill, at great length, both last session and also this session in the Health and Human Services Committee. Some of the members of this committee are also there, and we'll recall all that testimony in great detail. This bill is before you today because it has a fiscal note, it's with the Special Revenue Fund. And what I have is Shirley Brecken, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, to explain the bill's impact on her operation. So,
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Senator Gerlach, and members of the committee for hearing us today. The majority of the costs that you see in the fiscal note are related to notification to licensees, for development and disbursement of educational materials, especially for employers, and programming changes to the board's database and online services. These are basically one-time costs. An example that I'll give you is that the nurses who are residents in Minnesota will have to make a declaratory statement that Minnesota is their state of residence. So that's a change that would have to be made to our online services. About 90% of nurses use our online services to conduct their licensing business. The continuing costs of $6,000 are for the membership fee and costs associated with the Nurse Licensure Compact Administrators, and this is the organization which administers the compact, not the practice of nursing in Minnesota. The Board of Nursing will continue to regulate the practice of nursing in Minnesota. The board does not anticipate a loss of revenue due to this change, and the result will basically be revenue neutral. The board revenues currently are sufficient to cover these costs, and there will be no need to increase the licensure fee. And given that information, it would stand for questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Brecken? Senator Stump?
Madam Chair, maybe just a question on are we and do we have an adequate supply of nurses in Minnesota?
Ms. Brecken?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, we have that's a challenging question to answer because we have about 112,000 licensed nurses in Minnesota. Right now, nursing education programs tell us that the graduates are having not difficulty getting job as much as not getting a job where they would be their first choice. We have for a long time been an exporter of nurses. In other words, we graduate more nurses than the demand is for them. As of, you might expect, a lot of the young nurses or the new graduates are much more enamored of places like California and Florida than Minnesota. So that's not unusual for us to see the number of graduates leaving the state.
Question is the it seems like and I know they have a national kind of a registry or at least some equality or some quality type measure for certain professions, and I think nursing is one of them, but I think over the years we've always kind of prided ourselves in the quality of the training that nurses got in Minnesota. How do we maintain that under a system like where there's a compact? And does a nursing board screen candidates that want to join the compact or come to Minnesota?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, the premise of the compact is that each state board of nursing determines the eligibility for licensure in its own state. It is a state-based model, including Minnesota. All boards of nursing require that an individual graduate from an approved school of nursing and that they take the same national licensure examination. And the pass rate is the same for everybody across the country. I appreciate the fact and that you say that in Minnesota we educate nurses well, and I believe we do. Unfortunately, in the last few years, we have noted that the graduates of the associate degree nursing programs have a pass rate, and by pass rate I mean that the school itself, how many of its graduates pass the national licensure examination, is lower than the national average. We have shared this information with MNSCU, and we've just calculated it for this past year, and that held true, and we are again sharing that information with MNSCU. That doesn't mean that those individuals aren't safe to practice. I mean, they've passed, but they are below the national average, that the programs are, not the individuals. And that's of concern to the Board of Nursing and the nursing community, and is bringing that information again forward to the MNSCU system.
Sure. Madam Chair, I haven't, been able to listen to the debate and discussion on this bill, but I think we have the same kind of a situation in some of our other education areas. Minnesota has the highest SAT scores in the nation. We have a very high graduation rate, but then we do have in education kind of a gap in certain areas where we need improvement. One of the things that I would hope that doesn't happen is that the quality is diminished by some action that we would take and not kind of maintain that quality that we have had, for many, many years. And so that's a concern I have. I think we do produce enough nurses in Minnesota. I mean, when you look at our higher education system, there's many, many programs. In fact, maybe too many. And so I guess I personally don't see why we need to have a compact with, I don't know how many other states, but if we are going to, let's say, open the doors to who knows who.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Stump, I could address some of your concerns here. It's more of the policy of the bill as opposed to the fiscal note before us, but very simply, as far as the quality goes, that any nurse practicing in Minnesota will be subject to the practice laws and discipline laws of the state that they are in, that they are practicing in. So we would not be lowering any standards by any means for any nurses practicing here under the compact. And there are currently 24 other states that are members of the compact, so half the country is. And I believe that this opens up a lot of employment opportunities for our nurses here as well to practice and have opportunities to earn a living. It provides a lot of job independence to a lot of folks, not just women, but men as well, anybody who's in the nursing profession. And it provides those opportunities. And the third point, now I've lost my track. I was making mental notes of your points. The third one was the
Add that one. Ms. Bracken?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, and other members of the committee. I think the thing that Senator Gerlach referred to in his opening remarks talked about the way healthcare is delivered today. Patients and healthcare systems cross state lines all the time, whether it is telephonically or through other telehealth means, or patients come to Minnesota for care because of the kind of care that's available here. Then they go home to their own home state, and nurses care for them through telehealth. That nurse, and the same would be true with case managers, have to be licensed in all those other states where the patients go. So it really is providing for continuity of care as well as access to care for patients. It is really it's a reform for the way healthcare is delivered today, rather than a licensure system that is over 100 years old.
Madam Chair,
and I would like to bring up the other testifier who's scheduled on our agenda, Carrie Mortrude. And I do want to stick to the fiscal impacts as much as possible. In our materials, members, we have a question and answer about the Nurse Licensure Compact. There's also letters of support from the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Nursing, the Sanford Health, Mayo Clinic, St. Luke's, Health Partners, Essentia Health. So there's other material here that will give us some more background. And we're trying to focus as much as we can on this special government fund where the license fees go into, and where this fiscal note is coming from for the $149,000.
Madam Chair, can I add to that point, to your point? I want to ask Senator Gerlach, how come the Minnesota Nurses Association is not on this list of supporters?
Senator Goodwin, we have someone from their association right up at the table.
Excellent. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Mortrude, and I'm a public policy specialist and government relations staff with the Minnesota Nurses Association. I'll try to be brief. We do oppose Senate File 230, the National Nurse Licensure Compact, for multiple reasons, and as everyone noted, we had a hearing in health policy. We do see it as a potential job loss for nurses in Minnesota, as other nurses can now come take jobs. There's patient safety issues, a race to the bottom, Senator Stump, that's what we're concerned about, and states' rights, giving up states' rights. But to focus on the fiscal note, we do believe that it will increase nurse licensure fees here. We don't understand how it's not going to, in the fact that other states, Iowa had a cost of $130,000, Virginia $627,000, Mississippi's revenues decreased by 51%, and Colorado had a cost of $327,000. And that's all noted in the American Nurses Association 2007 talking points in opposition to the compact. So we're still unclear how this isn't going to raise nurse licensure fees. And along with the other policy reasons we stated, we oppose and would hope that you would oppose it as well.
Are there any questions for our testifier?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Ms. Mortrude, would you talk a little more about the loss of revenue in the other states? Our fiscal note talks about there's going to be an increase in endorsement applications and a decrease of renewals. And that seems to be kind of counter to the way I would think of this. Can you give us a little shed a little more light on that?
I'll answer where our questions arise as well, in that if we join the compact, why would there be an increase in nurse licensure endorsements? Because once we're in the compact, then people can freely come here. And the only way you'd pay the licensure by endorsement is if you're coming from a non-compact state. So why would us becoming a compact state all of a sudden attract non-compact state nurses to come here, therefore increasing a nurse licensure fee for the licensure by endorsement? It doesn't seem to make sense, unless the compact is a gateway into everywhere if you come from a non-compact state, and we don't understand that to be the case.
Ms. Brecken, would you want to address that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Right now, there is a law that provides that nurses from Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota may practice in Minnesota under their current Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, or North Dakota law. Minnesota nurses do not enjoy the same. They cannot go to those states and practice on their Minnesota license. All of those states belong to the compact. I contacted Iowa, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and North Dakota, our bordering states, which is where you would really expect the most number of nurses to be practicing in Minnesota under that license. If you think of Duluth and Rochester and Minneapolis, St. Paul, and its proximity to the Wisconsin border. Contacting those states, I first of all looked at our database for all nurses who have a Minnesota license but have a an address in a border state. Then I contacted those border states, and I asked them for the number of nurses that they had who were licensed in that state and have a Minnesota address. And essentially, it was a wash. Actually, it was a gain of about 300, that given that difference, that there would be those that would come that would be required to get a Minnesota license. But recall that right now, those border state nurses are practicing in Minnesota without a Minnesota license. They're not currently even, you know, and we have about 400 of those nurses who are, that we know of, that are practicing in Minnesota on that license, but Minnesota nurses can't do the same.
That's right. But, Madam Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
On that point, my niece was a nurse licensed in Minnesota, and she was in the traveling nurse program, and she practiced in New Mexico and Florida and New Hampshire and Colorado and California and Washington with just her Minnesota license. She never got a license in those states to practice. She was just in the traveling nurse program.
Ms. Brecken?
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, she would have been required to get a license in all of those states in which she was practicing, unless she was licensed in another compact state. Arizona is a compact state. Colorado is a compact state. New Mexico is. New Hampshire is. I think those were the states that you named.
California.
California is not a member of the compact.
Well, she practiced there for some time.
Senator Goodwin, then she would have been required to get a license in California. That is the same as any traveling nurse who would come from California or Colorado or Texas and come to work in Minnesota. They have to get a Minnesota license right now.
Senator Higgins, and we need to move on. The other committee is scheduled to start in 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll talk fast. There are two things about the fiscal note that bother me, and I've already forgotten what one of them was, so that'll make it easier. The one thing that I have known is that this bill has been before us for umpteen years. Senator Burlock, somebody's had some version of the compact bill for a long time. Do I remember that correctly?
Senator Higgins, it hasn't been before you many, many times. Actually, this is I will tell you that I was the first person I'm aware that introduced it about 6 years ago.
About six years ago.
Not receive a hearing for several years. And then about 4 years ago, Senator Marty gave it an informational hearing with no vote in his committee. And then last year it was heard and enrolled into included in the omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill, which was vetoed by the governor, the omnibus bill was. And then this year, again, you're seeing it as standalone.
So, Madam Chair, and so the Board of Nursing has, I think, a vested interest in making Minnesota a compact state. And we have a fiscal note that, you know, is very rosy and cheerful. And I just kind of question that the information that's in here may not tell us the whole story. And I don't know whether licensure compacts are a good thing or a bad thing. I just know that, you know, starting in the beginning of this century, states have been questioning whether to join the compact, and fewer than half of them have. And I think there's a reason for that, and I think we ought to be very cautious in going down this path.
Members, the bill does have to go to Senator Perry's committee because there's a section in here on rulemaking that hadn't been noticed before. So it will be referred there. It isn't its last stop yet. So with that, I would like to have Senator Hahn will make a motion that Senate File 230 be recommended to pass and sent to state government on that motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay?
No.
The motion does prevail. Senate File 230 will be sent to state government.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Senator.
And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned. But just a quick reminder that we're running over because we're starting very late. If members could please be here promptly at 8:30, we can get going and we won't have an overrun of time. Thank you.